Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Today I'm speaking with Lily Tomlin, one of America's most loved actresses and comedians. Lily is also a writer and producer and has won several Tony and Emmy Awards, plus a Grammy Award, and has been nominated for an Academy Award. Renowned for her versatility, Lily Tomlin's interest in theatre and performing arts began at Wayne State University. After college, she began doing stand-up comedy in nightclubs in Detroit and later in New York City. Her first television appearance was on The Merv Griffin Show in 1965. She's created many famous characters in her 40-year career, including the gum-chewing, wise-cracking, snorting telephone operator Ernestine and the bratty 5-year-old Edith Ann. Some of her film characters, Linnea Reese, a straight-laced, gospel-singing mother of two deaf children who has an affair with a country singer played by Keith Carradine in Robert Altman's Nashville. Lily and Bette Midler played two pairs of identical twins who were switched at birth in the 1989 comedy Big Business. She also performed several comedic roles in the 1981 film The Incredible Shrinking Woman and was a sickly heiress in the Steve Martin comedy All of Me. Lily Tomlin has also enjoyed success in television with roles in the popular sitcoms Murphy Brown and Will and Grace. She also starred on the dramatic series The West Wing from 2002 to 2006 in the recurring role of the presidential secretary, Deborah Federer. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Why are you laughing?
I was just waiting as it was coming up.
I haven't finished yet. Lily Tomlin is still making audiences laugh and is still actively raising awareness of important political issues. So why did you laugh, Lily?
Oh, just because I was listening to you, enumerate those different parts and different things you were. I don't know. It's your accent, and it always made me smile. And then when I could see Federer coming.
Yeah, well, I wasn't sure whether to say Federer.
I know. Everybody always, had fun with that name.
Well,
even Debbie Federer in her opening episode, she mispronounced her own name. Because she was supposed to be, have taken pills, but she was so nervous to go to see the president.
Oh, yeah. Well, God, I just loved West Wing. And, sometimes when I finish watching an episode, I think, this is real. This is reality. We're not really dealing with the fantasy of George Bush. This is really the president,
Oh, and indeed. And then some of us would have a suspension of disbelief, and we actually thought we were in the White House and that Jed Bartlett was the president, which was one ray of hope in our lives at the time. So often they were ahead of the curve. They would talk about issues that then would suddenly be, it would just be perfect. It would come in right into sync with what was going on in life and in government and the media.
Yeah, well, I know that I got to brief the writers of West Wing. Must have been about 16 people there, about nuclear war and nuclear power. And then the next, and I met Aaron Sorkin and everything. And then the next thing, They did an episode on, they did several, one on nuclear power and I think in Meltdown, and they did one on, the threat of nuclear war.
They were, they very, very carefully and fully researched stuff and brought in experts and to give them flesh stuff out and give them information and give them the lowdown.
Yeah, I mean, it was such a juxtaposition with the Bush administration. We'll get into some personal stuff in a while, Lily, but you as an American citizen, a very well-informed, intelligent American citizen, how are you feeling about the state of your country now?
I'm terribly distressed by it. I mean, and with the economy and the housing, it was bad enough with the war and our reputation and the destruction that we were initiating way across the world. And now all this is starting to collapse in on, just the average person and the American people in general. And it... It's pretty distressing because no one, the people in charge really don't seem to care.
Mm.
I mean, everything's been done, you know, frightfully to, it seems, to line their pockets. I mean, the fact that they would trade human beings for money. I mean, there's a wonderful old Aardman, you know, the claymation people who did stop motion clay animation in England.
Mm.
And they were just brilliant. Nick Park is from that group, the one who did, who is associated with Gromit and Wallace, you know, and mm-hmm. many other things. But they did a wonderful piece once, and they always did, what they do is take documentary soundtracks, and then they would animate to it. And this one was as if it was a big meeting with capitalists, and it was the chant was people or profits, people or profits. and they were clearly coming down on the side of profits.
Ugh.
And it didn't matter, and there was a sense of doom, impending doom. And this was, you know, some time ago.
Well, you know, it takes us back to the Iraq War, and just the other day, God almighty, five huge oil companies moved in to take over the oil in Iraq. And although they would say, you know, it's nothing about oil and capitalism, obviously it has been. I mean, it just makes you feel sick in the stomach, for me,
yeah,
anyway.
Yeah, it really does. Well, it's beyond that. There's almost no way you can even talk about it in any kind of simple human terms, because there's so much suffering and destruction behind it, and so much inequity and exploitation of people and resources in a country and of our own people. That's what's so, not that one people is more important than another, but the fact that people can, it's always been extremely stressful anyway to think that somebody can make the decision to send young people into combat.
Mm.
Into danger and not think first. What is this the absolute final resort that we can come to?
Mm.
That's a terrifying, awful thing. I think it harks back to when Bush did that silly, awful thing that pretending right at the when after the war had started and all the talk about WMDs and they didn't really exist, and he's saying, there must be some weapons of mass destruction in here somewhere. It's one of those big, you know, politicians' dinners.
Mm.
You remember that news footage, and it was, and that smirky look on his face and attitude. I even used to be stunned by, in the first Iraq War, when I would read so much about it, and I understand the soldiers, the flyers, maybe having to come back and somehow inure themselves to the fact of what they're really doing, you know, bombing sites and killing humans.
Yeah.
But I would read how they would high-five each other, you know, if they made a good strike. And I'll forgive that just because they're people put into that position, and I'll accept that maybe they don't want to really be there, or if they are, they don't really get that it's more than just someone telling them to do it. But the high-fiving used to just fill me with just a sickening, the idea that you have to, that it's like a sport.
Yeah, it is like a sport. And, you know, one of the books I want to write next, if I ever get round to it, is going to be called Why Men Kill. And I'm going to dedicate it to Donald Rumsfeld, whose picture will be on the frontispiece. But do you know what I found out, Lily? I found out that the men who take off from the aircraft carriers on their bombing runs, do you know they show them porno films before they take off?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That doesn't surprise me.
There's some funny sort of connection between sexuality or sex and killing. I don't quite understand it. And then, of course, why do conquering soldiers rape women when they conquer a territory? I know that the UN has just passed a resolution against rape. You know, it's a bit delayed, but they at last have done it. But I don't understand all of this, silly, these dynamics at all.
Well, I want to believe in the humanity of most men and the basic goodness of most men, just as part of a huge part of our species. And you think, well, when people are thrust into these situations, it harks back to Kissinger saying power is the ultimate aphrodisiac.
Yep.
I mean, whatever that that sense of dominance is, and why any one group wants to dominate another group is more than I can understand or feel anyway. Rather than wanting to reach out, even just because there's a split, you know, the females are supposed to be the nurturers, which is not always true, and the males are always the warriors or the hunters or whatever they're supposed to be. But we're way beyond, you know. Maybe we're never going to be more than this kind of some animalistic impulse. I don't know. I pray not.
I know. What about, you know, this is just a wild suggestion, but you could do a fantastic show on capitalism, Lily, and where it's going. You could have a lot of fun with that. It's like, you know, search for intelligent life in the universe. It's sort of on the same sort of level.
Search for intelligent capitalism, or search for what? I don't know. You're right. It would be good. There's
you could have
lot
a ball
type, but,
with that.
But you have to try to make something really, you know, I'm pursuit is always to do something, you know, metaphorical that is somehow ennobling in some way, no matter how far, whatever you have to go through to get there. But I, you know, I'm always wanting to make it something that more honors humanity than debases it.
Which is what you do. But, I mean, I always think of Cheney as the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain, although the Wizard of Oz was a decent sort of fellow, I think, when they finally found him. But, you know, this is this person that
I'm surprised someone hasn't... Has anybody used that image? Because that's, that's a good image.
Yeah, you finally get to the curtain, and there he is.
And yet the Oz, you know, for all that, all those machinations, he turns out to be fairly benign, totally benign, really, except... So you're right. It's another. We have a very different ending.
Oh, it's so scary, Lily. I just wish I could bury my head in the sand like an ostrich and pretend everything is all right. And but you know, I kind of can't, because I sort of intuitively know what's going on. And I suppose you're the same. Are you?
Well, you've known it for a long time. I mean, you've led a lot of people to that realization. I mean, I can say that I'm in a situation where I'm not faced with it in a literal way in life. I mean, yes, I'm aware of it, and yet we're all, you know, after certain creature comforts, because it's just a human desire, and osmotically we want to go push through that membrane to something more comfortable, easier. But no, it's very hard to enjoy your freedom and your comforts when so many people are in need and are hurt, and hurt just for the dollar. That's what. But it's all collapsing around us.
Yeah.
I'm still so amazed at anybody who even will admit that they voted for Bush, but they do. People will say, "I was with somebody not too long ago, and I didn't know her very well, but I came to know her, and I liked her very much as a person. But her history, you know, she's very conservative, and not entirely conservative, but she said, well, I think President Bush has done an okay job. I mean, that's how much, that's all she would allow. And I took her head in my hands, and my heart just ripped for her to even want to convince herself that that was true. And I said, No, he did not do an okay job.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, and I kissed her on the cheek. That's all I could do. I felt like I had to, like, take care. I had to somehow give her some information that she could say that it wasn't okay, that she still had to kind of fudge a little bit and say it was okay. And she was smart. She was a plenty smart person, but how people can come down on that side of issues and things just because she was a person of means too, so
she wants,
you know,
to keep
people
her
want to
means.
Protect themselves
they yeah
protect,
they want to keep
their
means yeah
property literally.
I know, it's really queer. You know, we're having a big celebration. It's called the World Youth Day in Sydney at the moment, and the Pope is here, and there are, I don't know, 150,000 pilgrims from all over the world, and the Pope flies in this huge aeroplane with, you know, his red shoes and all the pomp and circumstance. And I can't help keep thinking of what Jesus said, you know, it's more difficult for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven than a camel to pass through the eye of a needle. And
right.
How many Americans call themselves Christians yet, unless you, you know, really walk in the shoes of the fisherman, you can't call yourself a Christian, I think.
Well, there's been absolute teaching to the opposite of that, you know, that Christians are they just, and I'm not going to single out the Christians entirely, because most religious people think that they're the blessed ones, but certain preachers have spun it. Again, I'm sure the dollar is a motivating force, because you're going to get a bigger congregation if you preach that you should have material things, you should have a big house, and you should have plenty of cars, and you should have fine clothes, and you should be able to, because you're blessed. you're one of God's chosen people. You know, everybody else is going to go to hell.
I know. It's the antithesis of anything that Jesus preached. I remember talking to him.
But there's been enough of that people, you know, there's just groups who they seek out other Christians to do business with them, and they're all happy. And who knows what their mode of business is. I hope it's...
Well, who knows?
like Jesus. Oh, Helen, it's too much. I mean, if you focus on it, it's profoundly upsetting.
I know.
If you line everything up in a row, it's so overwhelming that I don't think you could continue. You've always amazed me because your knowledge is so deep and so broad, and you know things most of us never have known. And in fact, you reveal so much that people haven't known, and yet you somehow you've kept your a much more loving, lively person that's in the world, and giving that kind of vibe off. You know, I'd have to probably take to my bed if I knew as much as you do.
Well, Lily, why don't we talk about I'm interviewing, of course, the wonderful Lily Tomlin. Lily, why don't we talk about how we first met?
Okay.
What's your recollection?
My recollection is we were doing Earth Day here in L.A. or one of the Annie New concerts at the Hollywood Bowl.
Yeah.
And I was doing, I think I was doing Trudy, the street person.
Yeah, I'd never seen you before. I didn't know who this mad woman was.
This is 30-some years ago, and Carter had just gone into a nuclear plant where there had been a leak or something, wearing those yellow plastic booties.
Yeah, Three Mile Island, that's right.
Oh, yeah, that's right, Three Mile Island.
And he took his wife in there, too, yeah.
So Trudy was running around in some yellow plastic booties and... telling everybody, you know, that they could protect themselves from radiation with these yellow plastic booties, or just trying to satirize that whole thing, I suppose, and carrying on. And I heard you speak, and I was just knocked out. And then we continued to do things together. Sally Field and I both would join you on television or try to be present when you were speaking, just so that the messages you had could get out and draw a larger audience.
Well, let me recount.
Is that what you're recalling?
Yeah, I'm recalling. I don't know if the first time we did it was either with Merv Griffin or Lily or Phil Donahue, but let me recount what I remember. You and Sally were on for the first half hour. We had a whole hour. I think it was Donahue. And Sally sitting in the makeup room with her hair all in curlers and getting stuff done. And you were pacing the corridor with reams of paper, learning all the numbers of weapons and all the technology and stuff. So when you went on, by the time I came on half an hour later, you'd covered the whole subject. There was nothing for me to talk about.
Yeah, but was it coherent?
Totally coherent, Lily. Yeah,
I hope you straightened things out.
No, I didn't need to. You could be me. I mean, I didn't need to say a thing. You'd covered the whole thing. And then
I was probably parroting all your words.
Oh, rhubarb. Remember when we went to Mexico? Do you remember when we went to Mexico to play
the highlight games?
Yes.
Yes, right.
And we went down and I think we won some money, actually, and we came back and the television in the limo you had was playing Nancy Reagan, and she was talking about the little gun that she kept under her pillow when Ronnie was away.
Oh, yeah. You know, Patty Davis wrote a book about mothers, and I participated in it.
Oh.
I don't know if it's been published yet, but the one she wrote about her mother, it's really so wrenching because... people who have been involved in so many things that you just don't have any, you might have a very negative view of, and then anything human about them, you know, and Patty recounted a story about a pair of pearls, I think, that maybe Barbara Bush had given Nancy Reagan, I don't remember, but it's really a testament to Patty's memory and writing about it, but it was very moving about Nancy and how, you know, they were basically somewhat estranged, even though they've come closer together. But, you know, you don't know why you can't reach that human part of someone like Cheney. You think, well, there isn't one. In fact, I used to do a line, you know, after the election in 2006, I'd say, gosh, Vice President Cheney has been more morose than usual. And I said, but Lynn Chaney said that's what turned her on in the first place.
Well, you know, I'll never forget after.
God.
Yeah, I'll never forget after that election, Lily. There was the vice president and Lynn, and George Baby and Laura, and now up on the stage, I think George had the twins, and Chaney had his daughter who is gay with her partner. The whole election was run by Rove, Karl Rove, against gays. And,
absolutely.
Yeah, I know. And here was standing up there, the sort of metaphor for what they ran the election against. And this woman was gay, and I think she was also already pregnant.
I'm not sure she was pregnant yet, but she did become pregnant later.
And he has got a grandbaby, and I'm sure he loves his grandbaby, but how do you get through? I remember when I went to see General Benny L. Davies, the head of STRATCOM, the Strategic Air Command in Omaha, Nebraska. And I was ushered into his office, and his whole office was covered with missiles. Everywhere you looked, there was a missile on a shelf, the bookshelf, you know, it was sort of talk about phallic symbols. And he talked about the Soviets and how wicked and evil they were for about 20 minutes. And I just couldn't crack this facade, you know, we've got to, if necessary, you know, have a nuclear war and kill them all sort of thing.
Well, I'm surprised he saw you.
Well, yeah, I don't know why, but anyway,
that's a testament to you, to your reputation, to get an, you know, to have an audience with someone like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, well, I suppose I was sort of in the media at that time a lot, but anyway, at the end, I said to him, I turned to him, and I said, "Have you got grandchildren?" And he sort of halted and stumbled a bit, and he said, "Yes." And I said, "Well, how old are them? Are they?" And he said, 2 and 10 months, and suddenly his face just cracked, and I'd got into his soul in a way, you know, and we virtually, I said, "Well, what about their future?" And he conceded then. I mean, it's like Carter at Camp David with Sadat and Begin, you know. He couldn't get them together until he finally got them to show him photographs of their grandchildren, and then the three of them could talk. That's what you were talking about, you know, their humanity.
Well, listen, I used to say even on every level in life here in California, where in this town in L.A.,
yeah,
where there are so many people, like satellite people, you know, you have accountants and you have a publicist and you have a manager and an agent and a this and a that. And I always found when people would say something to me, like I had an accountant once and he'd say, I said, you know, I just read or learned something about like somebody that he had recommended to me who might be another financial person, and I'd say, he literally he sold me these instruments that I just read a big article about, and they're totally false and inappropriate for anybody, and they're going to stop allowing them to even sell them, and I said, and he's handling your father-in-law's money. I said, don't you think that you need to speak to him about it, the fact that he's doing this immoral thing, and he knows very well what he's doing?
Yeah.
And he said, well, and he kind of thumped around it. And I said, and I'd always get on my high horse, you know, and say, is this the kind of world you want where you just turn your turn away from when anybody commits anything, even the smallest act of immorality or deception or cheating? And I was forever, I really was, I would try to, I would confront that on any moment that I would meet somebody, you know. And of course, I become a little more accepting of people's human frailties. But still, as you say, someone like Karl Rove, all those people, Rumsfeld, it's that same thing about sending young people into battle. I mean, the idea that they would send somebody to a phony war is unbelievable. And that's because they have to think they're so right, or do they have no connection with other human beings at all? I can only think that they are just so cut off, so cold, so, and somehow even their own grandchildren, like you said, this guy's face breaks, but I find it hard to believe that that's so momentary, because what is it cut off in them that allows them to see the world, have a world view like that, that that one particular way of life is so superior to another that you just have to destroy the other way of life, or you do anything to destroy life just to make money. I I know I'm rambling, but I...
It's good rambling.
I don't know where that that lack of empathy comes from, absolute lack of empathy, except for this and smug snide. It's like when Karl Rove and Karen Hughes, remember after Carrie was so foolish to shoot those ducks and wear that camouflage, and then they get off a plane that night or the next day, dressed in camouflage. They'd been on one of those big hunting things. Have you ever seen that picture of Karl Rove leaning on a bison that he shot, like in one of those cage, those trapped environments, like where Cheney always went and shot poor birds
that were released from cages,
released from a net or a pen or whatever.
Yeah.
Oh, it's loathsome. I don't know where. I just don't know where people have you don't want to. You can't believe that you can. That there's just business. Let's say business and art. And that there's some divide in there, and the person who is inclined to be more of an artist is more empathetic, more sensitive, a pushover, too soft, and the other people have to be so hard, so cut off. I don't believe it. I think that I just don't know how those people can possibly grow up and exist as they are.
Well,
I don't know where they came from, why they think their way of doing things or surviving or dominating is the best thing in the world for all of. I sat next to a guy in Texas who's extremely rich, and I've seen him in Forbes and stuff many times. And I'd been invited there just as I was. I had a friend who got me in because I was doing some research on a Texas project, and I sat next to this fellow. And of course, he said to me, "Oh, you're from Hollywood, and you're just brainwashed." And I said, "Well, why don't you educate me?" You know, I said, maybe I could learn something here tonight. And I really engaged him. But as the evening went on, he bragged to me that he had been he said he was the architect, really, but I understand there were more than one. He was the architect or one of the architects of the Swift Boat campaign against Kerry.
Oh, my God.
And later in the evening, and I said, are you telling me that because that's something you're proud of? And then at the end of the evening, I said, well, don't you think we just try to make the world a little better for just a few more people? And he said completely, quickly, emphatically, curtly, he said, no.
Did he?
And he said, no. He said, let the free market go and it'll take care of everything. I said, well, it's done a good job right now.
Like people are lining up at the banks to pull their money out. You know, the last time people did that was the Great Depression, Lily.
I know. Don't say anything. It's pretty horrendous.
I know.
I know somebody just through another friend who lost, or he's getting 50 cents on the dollar of his savings.
Yeah. I'm talking to the wonderful Lily Tomlin. And just to talk about my experience, Lily, I'm a doctor, and I treat these characters who've lived really quite, I have to say, wicked lives.
Yeah.
On their deathbed, or when their children are dying, they'll fall into my arms and weep and recant and tell me the sort of lives they've lived. And they often change at that point in time because they see the fragility of life and how precious it is. But it's not until they reach that point themselves or they're dying that they realize what they've done.
Yeah.
Why is it that some people can know that, like you, all the way along, and others are totally blocked out to it? And I also think it's part of the societal dynamic, particularly in the United States, you know?
Yeah. Well, maybe, you know, we still are so puritanical and provincial in so many ways, and we don't really deal much with death, you know, and I think people, it's like Mel Gibson, when he got into all that fracas with the police on,
when he was drunk
on Pacific Coast, or he pled with, or he had that outburst about he just had to believe, you know, that he was going to go to heaven someday or whatever his words were. He just couldn't live if that weren't true. That if he weren't going to maybe it was to see his mother again. I don't know.
I
don't think some people can really come to terms. They're so narcissistic. I don't think they can see themselves ending.
Yeah.
Politicians have to be somewhat narcissistic. I don't know how they can be. I just don't know how you could live. And you know, if I step on a snail outside, I usually just am just a bit overwrought about it. You know, I just hate this kind of, some kind of accidental killing is an awful, awful thing. But then purposeful killing is really hard to live with, unless you're a murderer. Yeah. Unless that's you're so cut off that you're able to murder, that life means nothing to you.
Well,
but I understand what you're saying about people collapsing at the end or having some revelation at the end, but by golly, it's not soon enough, is it?
No. So many thoughts are flooding through my head as you talk. You know, it's how do you wake people up to their humanity? I guess that when I give speeches, I give data after data after data, you know, so people think, well, I think she knows what she's talking about. And then they sort of settle down. And then I go for their guts, so to speak, you know, to where they really live and try and engender their emotions. And I find that most people underneath really love to smell the roses and the wisteria orange blossom and, you know.
I totally agree. That's why I said I have to believe in the humanity of most men, most women. I can't, you know, but where do these few ruthless people come from that want to dominate or don't care about the destruction of other people or their... I used to do another line. All this goes back to, you know, when Bush had so much approval in the country, yeah. Which was so hard to understand. And it was like Ernestine was talking to Ernestine, the telephone operator, is talking to Bush, and
do
President
her
Bush,
Lily go on.
What
do her go on?
Oh, like something like she'd say like, well, of course the Iraqi people haven't shown you enough appreciation. They, Hallmark hasn't made a card yet for thank you for destroying our country. You know, that, I mean, there was so much you could do at that time because, and I even had people in, I was playing Flint one time, Flint, Michigan, where Michael Moore is from.
Yeah.
And, of course, that city, I'm sure, is split severely. The people who adore him, and the people who don't really don't. And so, and people got in the audience. I had a question come up to the stage, and they said, who would you rather have for president, George W. Bush or the Marquis de Sade? And, of course, I started laughing because I just read the question cold, and I started laughing. And, oh, the audience got into a big uproar about the Iraq war and, you know, and people yelling, my child's over there fighting this war and you hate America and, you know, that kind of stuff. They really equate that kind of any kind of dissension with a lack of patriotism, a lack of caring.
Yeah, I thought that after 9/11, America turned in really into one big tribe.
Yeah.
It's tribalism, really, and projecting the anger out onto others.
Maybe I was probably really naive at the time, but I thought, you know, we didn't. I don't think President Bush made that speech until about 3 weeks after the bombing.
Mm.
And I kept thinking, Ever hopeful. I kept thinking, it's going to be so ironic that this fellow is going to be the one who does something differently.
Yeah.
That he's not going to attack immediately. He's not going to retaliate. He's going to do something magnificent. It's like in The Search for Signs of Intelligent Life in the Universe, Jane Wagner's play. Trudy, the street person at the end of the play, says, you know, she all through the play she's talking about goosebumps and why do humans get goosebumps? Why do we get them collectively? Why can we be in an audience and see something that's so moving about ourselves or about humanity that we all get goosebumps? We listen to a piece of music, we get a lump in our throat, and we have these feelings that can sweep through us and unify us. So she says, after she's done all that and talked about humans having this experience, then she says about her space chums who have been traveling here to find intelligent life in the universe. She says, and someday maybe we'll do something so magnificent, everybody in the universe will get goosebumps. And I'm thinking, and so I have this hopeful idea that, yes, this is possible. Maybe we had the world in our corner, and we had a moment to show that there's another way to deal with
Absolutely.
Things.
Absolutely.
And I really thought this was possible. I don't know how I could have been such a schnook at that time, but...
Well, yeah, through the retrospectoscope,
when you see... And then you know what else happened?
What?
And maybe, and I'd like to get your view on this, because when after during 9/11, when and the plane that was, you know, came down in Pennsylvania, because when the people realized what was happening, they tried to turn the plane around.
Yeah.
And I felt, after we attacked, I felt like that plane had been a metaphor for this country. And if we had known, you know, we would be trying to turn this, we would never have allowed this to proceed.
Well, you know, it seems from the Lancet, which is the British medical journal, that probably over 1 million civilians now have been killed in Iraq, and the place has just been decimated. Everything that was set up for civil society, the hospitals are destroyed, the sewage system doesn't work, people are being electrocuted because they put in the electrical cables the wrong way. Huge amounts of money have been ripped off by Kellogg, Brown and Root and Halliburton and Cheney's people. But just that leads me on to the next thing, Lily. I'm obviously interviewing the redoubtable Lily Tomlin. Tell me what you think of Obama, because he has had the courage to say and the wisdom that he wouldn't bomb Iran. He'd go and talk to them, which is the sort of thing you've just been saying, right?
Did I cut you off?
No, it's all right. It's just the sort of thing you've been saying.
In that early debate when that issue came up, and he said yes, he would go and talk to them. And of course they pulled back, Hillary pulled back, and the others too, saying that was naive, and that was, you know, you don't go to speak with someone who's satanic or these awful people unless there are conditions met and so on. And of course it's not I couldn't understand the uproar. I thought, oh, at last somebody has said something that really means something, that has a glimmer of something different.
Yep.
And he had to modify that. Of course, it's the old saw anyway. You know, you run in one particular sensibility during the nomination campaign, or whatever you call it, the pre-election, and then in the general, you run to the center.
So how are you feeling about
it? I still have every hope that Obama's going to make a difference.
Yeah.
But the system is so entrenched, you think, is it possible? It's the same thing. Is it possible that that we're not going to retaliate, that we're going to somehow take a different tack after 9/11? And so I'm still hoping, and I have that same hope, and I hope this time I'm not naive.
We really need a very strong leader who gets in, like Roosevelt, who really didn't worry about the capitalists, etc. He came in after the Great Depression and he set up the New Deal and he did what was right for the American people. And I'll never forget his white train going through the country after he died, Lily. Did you see that documentary on PBS and the look in the people's eyes?
Faces, yeah.
Adulation and grief.
Your words were exactly, he did it for the people. He didn't do it for his cronies.
Yeah.
And that, or for a particular particular small group.
And the capitalists hated him for the New Deal.
Yeah.
And if he hadn't died, the next thing he was going to do was nationalize medicine in America so that you would have free medical care.
Of course, yeah.
What are we going to do, Lily?
We have to hang in there for a few more months. Something good might happen. I just don't know. It's so, you know, and I mean, it's, I don't want to divide the world. I don't want to divide, Americans between the positive and the negative, or the liberal and the conservative. And I want to believe that there is more people in the middle. I have a Chinese doctor who would say to me, there's 5% of the world. He'd say this with an accent, though, but I'm not going to do that. He'd say 5% of the world is very, very bad, and 5% is very, very good. And it's the 5% that are bad and the 5% that are good that have to fight each other. And so, because the people generally, because people don't have the luxury of time and information. God knows they don't have any information now. They have a daily life to live. And like you said, most people want to smell the roses. And my mother used to say, I stop and smell the garlic. I tried the roses and they didn't work. So most people do just want to live a simple kind of life where they make a living and they raise their children and they educate them and they do whatever they do.
Yeah, but they're facing reality now, I think.
Yeah, they are.
You know, you could say this might be a good thing that especially in America, which is leading the world either towards survival or destruction, you know, it's the key country. Maybe this crisis that's occurring now, Lily, with both the economy...
How else could Obama have surfaced?
Oh, I suppose that's true, although he did surface...
I mean, he's part of this, hopefully, this sort of evolution of awareness.
Mm.
But people, it's like a cat or a dog knowing the earthquake's coming.
Yes. Maybe. I think underneath he's a highly intelligent, extremely wise person. I mean, the speech he gave on racism and, you know, some of the speeches that have been so profound. And this is him. This is the man.
In no way do I think Obama's perfect, and I certainly don't expect him to be. And that's one of the fallacies that people have, because they immediately... that's what the media does, too. They look for every little crack they can, and they, you know, drive a great big wedge in between.
Yeah.
So, but he seems to be different from what we usually endure.
Yeah. Lily, you once told me how you grew up in Detroit.
Yes.
Was it in the housing project, and how you developed your acting, how you'd go to different people's apartments and, you know... do little stand-up routines. Tell us about that briefly.
Okay.
Go on.
And this may be, you know, where you, when you're exposed to a lot of different people, and in this apartment house I was, plus it was a very racially mixed neighborhood, and it was predominantly black, so I had a lot of black, you know, friends I went to school with and went to their houses, and the old apartment house I lived in had every economic class and education and political. They were very radical people, very conservative, very apolitical, because older people lived there who were now on pensions and couldn't afford to leave, even though they probably wanted to move away from us. And my mother and dad, both, you know, they were working class Southerners who came up so my dad could work in the auto factories.
Mm.
And I was madly in love with the people in these apartments. Everyone was so different. And I'd be propagandized by one person in an apartment with communist literature and very radical literature. And I'd be going, then I'd spend my evenings with Mrs. Rupert, who was a botanist and was ultra-conservative, reactionary, really. And then all the Southerners that lived in the building, and then all the kids I went to school with. I was just immersed in this multi-diverse culture. And what I had the experience to see was how alike everybody was and how they all could be really base or they could be really high. And they all made me smile or laugh, and they all made me weep a bit, you know.
And didn't you do little stand-up routines?
Oh, God, yeah. I put on shows. I was I might as well have been like P.T. Barnum or something.
With your brother?
And if a new kid moved in the building, I would immediately try to, you know, cast him, create something for them to do. Like these two kids from Georgia moved in, Tommy and Billy Barnes, and they both had red curly hair and freckles. And as soon as I saw them, because I was influenced by radio and television, and I saw these two kids with red curly hair, and I said, Howdy Doody and Arthur Godfrey. So I was able to, like, make up material then for them to do and try to play those parts. And then I could play, you know, satellite parts like Holly Loki or anybody, or as Princess Summerfall, Winterspring, and stuff like that. And, of course, then they would half the time leave in the middle of the show, or they wouldn't show up for rehearsal.
Yeah.
And so I started working alone. I started doing it myself.
Didn't you do it with your brother, too?
I did it with my brother, and he did the same thing. And my brother is really funny. I mean, he's naturally funny.
Not like you.
I just sort of invent things to do that are funny. And he would just leave. We'd be playing this is later when I was, at the end of high school and then in college. And I used to work in the coffee houses in Detroit. And now I was really up, you know, I'd been influenced by Ruth Draper and all kinds of people. And I adored the monologue form, and I also like to do sketches with other people, and I would get something for my brother and me to do together, and he would just leave. He's in the middle of the show, he'd say, oh, this is so embarrassing, and he would, well, I guess he meant the material, and he'd walk off. And so I was really quite serious about pursuing it, so I really started doing it by myself.
So you started really young. This has been your whole raison d'etre all your life, really, hasn't it, Lily?
You know, I have done it always, but I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know that people did that and made a living doing it. I had a teacher in grade school who used to read old dialect poems to us on Fridays before we'd go home.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they're considered politically incorrect now in the school system because they were very phonetically written. They were, you know, German, Yiddish, Black, Italian. But they would be like a radio show. And as I say, we didn't get a TV till I was 10, and I loved radio so much.
Mm.
And also because I'd already been politicized just from the neighborhood I lived in.
Mm.
You know, there were houses. I went to school with kids who lived in what would be, to me at the time, were mansions. And I also went to school with kids who were like, you know, really not well off at all, pretty poor.
Mm.
But our school, the way our neighborhood is just the way it was. Kids came from, you know, several blocks, a concentric thing in neighborhood. And I was exposed to a lot of different classes. And I understood about, the biggest misconception I had for a long time, till maybe I was about 12 or 13, is that if people were intelligent, they would do the right thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you think that?
Yep, that morality would obviously be practiced.
Yeah, I thought I thought that was had to be true, but of course it isn't at all.
Then you look at Kissinger. Yeah. Well, Lily.
And the thing, you know, what really else irks me is that someone like Karl Rove, they'll call Karl Rove a mastermind.
Oh.
And they'll call Osama bin Laden a mastermind. I mean, it's such a bad use of language.
Yeah.
You know, they should be called for what they are, like, you know, demons or something. Karl Rove, I mean, the fact that anything goes and he has no morality whatsoever.
None at all. He's an evil perpetrator.
Yeah. It's.
Why don't people talk frankly and openly and be honest on the media?
I don't know how they've gotten away with this for so long. It's eroded so badly now that... After people's awareness turned so consciously and people began to back away from the war, you never had any of those commentators on any of the cable shows who absolutely fostered the war and supported Bush, and I mean on both sides of the aisle.
Yep.
They never stood up and said, you know,
we were wrong.
We should apologize to the American people.
Let alone
for
the Iraqi people.
Them.
Yes.
What?
Let alone the Iraqi people.
Oh, I mean, that goes without saying. I mean, it's just tragic. But the idea that they should have actually resigned. They should have stepped down from their jobs. Instead, they just went on just like they've never said anything positive at all about Bush or the war or been, and that embedding the reporters.
Ugh.
I knew that was the real strategy from the beginning.
Well, we did know that, but at last the New York Times did a sort of definitive piece on it.
Oh, you mean Judith Miller?
No, well, Judith Miller had 5 front page articles in the New York Times,
instigated
the war.
Well, no, now, but Cheney would plant that and then go on and quote it.
Oh, I know.
The manipulation is just unconscionable. It's I mean, and the fact that we're not taking any action is, again, it's one of the things that would exonerate us in the eyes of so many in this world.
Yeah, it's called humility, to say you're sorry.
Yeah, humility. Yeah, that's something that most politicians don't have.
Oh, dear Lily. Well,
I have gone on a bit.
No, but you're gorgeous. I just love you. And everyone else out there just loves you, Lily. And you give us joy.
Now, don't overstate it.
Pipe down, I'm doing this interview. You give us joy and hope, and anyone that can make you laugh like you do can make you happy and give you more energy to go on and do what we have to do, right?
Well, you know, I get that from the audience. I really do.
Yes.
I mean, people say, oh, God, you have so much energy. How can you do that night after night and all that stuff? And I'm high as a kite because of this is one of the things I loved about the search when I was doing it in New York.
Yeah.
I'd go outside after a show, and outside there would be like, this was back in the 80s at that time, and there would be like a yuppie couple just dressed to the teeth, gorgeous, you know.
Yeah.
And there'd be three women, you know, middle-aged women from middle America, you know, very, very homely dressed.
Mm.
And there'd be like two or three goth kids out there all punked out and with black lipstick and white makeup. And they would all be standing there in a little, you know, clump together where they wouldn't normally be together at all. And I could feel from the from Jane's words,
yeah,
this the play would speak and validate their humanity to such an extent,
yeah,
and make that collective experience in the audience at the end of the play that they would just want to, they would want to embrace me. It would be like this outpouring of affection. I felt so lucky to have that experience every night. The object of the play was to give the audience goosebumps, and of course, I was a part of the audience too, and I almost always had goosebumps at the end of the night, and it was like my reward, you know.
So, what are you doing now, Lily?
I'm doing a lot of concerts, and I did a series on HBO. That's how I happened to be in Texas when I sat at that dinner table with that fellow. And we did it for HBO, and it was about a very, very rich family in Texas. It was a comedy. It was written by Linda Bloodworth, who did Designing Women.
Mm.
But after the former head of HBO got fired for a personal infraction, then these two fellows came in over HBO, and the producers of our show and the two gentlemen at HBO didn't. So attractive with my language. The two, they got in terrible disputes over the scripts and the content and all kinds of stuff. And we shot six episodes, and they spent millions of dollars, but it's been shelved. It'll never be shown.
Oh, my God.
So I worked a long time on that. And I'm also, I'm a part of this website, wowohwow.com, which is a website that Liz Smith and Leslie Stahl from 60 Minutes,
yes,
and Mary Wells, who, you know, was the head of Wells Rich and Green years ago in New York. But she was a big ad person who was very famous. And and Joni Evans and Peggy Noonan. They were part of the founding group. And then there's a bunch of other people now involved, Candace Bergen and Whoopi and me and Marlo Thomas and Joan Ganz Cooney. And they invented it. Jane is in it, Jane Wagner, and we just kind of contribute to it now and then. Jane's been doing a lot of, she calls them care tunes, like eco cartoons, showing animals. And she's on a big polar bear kick,
is she?
Which is good, you know. And her drawings are charming, and she does stuff about the earth. And and Edith Ann also has a column,
oh,
Life in the
good.
Little Lane.
Edith Ann needs to have a column.
Yeah.
What was the name of your dog, your white fluffy dog?
Tess, my own real dog, or Edith's
you're
dog?
Your Tessie. Real dog that you used to take on the plane with you.
Yeah, Tess.
Yeah,
Tess.
Who died.
Yeah, she died. She died in 93 when O.J. was running in the Bronco.
Oh.
Now, see, that's an example of someone very narcissistic, and what does he think? He thinks he's the one that's put upon. So, you can imagine Karl Rove saying, why, these people, they've got, 15% of the world's resources, all these other people, that 15% belongs to me to make a full 100.
Well, Lily, I think that you need to do a show on everything that we've just talked about. I mean, you're very profound in your thinking, and You could satirize Karl Rove and all the rest of these characters. The guy you met in Texas. I mean, you could make a fantastic show.
Hopefully, he'll fade from memory soon.
Well, no, but it's very important that these people be brought out, and then
that's why Congress should take action, have done something about it.
Oh, I know.
I mean, not to even accuse them of stuff that's been done is unbelievable.
I thought Pelosi would do that, but she hasn't done it.
But that was right away. She took it off the table before they even won the election.
Impeachment. I know. Well, look, Lily, we're going to have to end, and we could talk for another hour and have more and more fun.
Yes, Helen, I would like to sometime.
Edith, sit down. Edith used to say,
Helen, I have to go to two different schools, one to learn about baby Jesus and one to learn about smog.
Well, Helen, I always love to talk to you.
Oh, it's been an absolute delight. I wish we were here at the same place. We could have dinner together.
I know, and I wish I could be there for your birthday.
Oh, yeah, it's going to be a bit of a ball, I think. 120 people coming from all over.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, yeah.
It would be great.
In a little tiny fishing village. Yeah.
Australia. How fabulous.
Well, we'll have to get you to Australia sometime, Lily.
All right.
Mm, you can have your own bathroom.
All right. Thank you so much. Lots of love to you.
Bye, darling.
Bye, Helen.
Today I've been speaking with Lily Tomlin, one of America's most loved actresses and comedians. It's been an absolute joy to be with Lily. We learned a lot, we talked a lot, and if you want to go to her websites, she's got two, lilytomlin.com or wowowow.com. That was Vultures by John Mayer. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott. Thank you very much for listening.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and edited by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.